Athens News Matters is sponsored in part by the WUGA Community Advisory Council, dedicated and involved individuals who help WUGA stay connected with our listeners, community organizations, and issues in the Athens area. Learn more at WUGA.org.
Today on Athens News Matters, after months of work and criticism from some activists, a plan for civilian police oversight may be up for a vote in a few weeks.
Within, 6 months or so, I'm hoping that we have this full operation running and going so that we can be establishing more and more trust between the community and the police department.
We'll talk to ACC Commissioner Tim Denson about the proposal. This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. Also today, Tommy Valentine from Historic Athens on the West Broad School site and the plans school board members saw last week. Plus, as the nation marks the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 terror attacks, we'll hear an audio essay from someone who was there on that fateful morning.
Those stories, plus our panel on the week in news and politics, coming up on Athens News Matters.
You know that feeling where you're exhausted by the news, but you also can't stay away from the news? I am here to help with that. My name is Sam Sanders. My show is called It's Been a Minute. Every week, journalists and I process the week of news and culture in a way that doesn't feel overwhelming. Listen to It's Been a Minute every week from NPR.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. The framework for a police civilian oversight board has been in the Athens-Clark County Government Operations Committee for months. Now it's beginning to reach its final stages, and commissioners could vote on it early next month. District 5 Commissioner Tim Denson is a member of the Government Operations Committee. We spoke earlier this week. Commissioner Denson, welcome back to Athens News Matters.
Thanks for having me.
Well, to start with, how did the idea for this board come about, and how could it benefit the Athens community?
Having a civilian police oversight has been talked about for quite a while, but a lot of it by, community organizers and activists over the years. And during a lot of the protests from last year, around the Black Lives Matter movement and around the death of George Floyd, I think really sparked and prioritized it and put it on the forefront. And so Mayor Gertz went ahead and created a task force of community residents to kind of give a framework for us to work from to see what's possible. And also we joined an organization called NACOL that oversees and helps and assists a lot of civilian oversight groups across the country. And they kind of work together to kind of give us a bit of a framework to start from. And that's what the Government Operations Committee has been working with at this point.
Right. So what does this draft ordinance that would create the board say?
There's two important parts that came out of the task force. And the two things that they recommended that we create here in Athens is, one, having the actual civilian group, which would be a group of residents who would give recommendations and hear about issues or possible violations that happen and complaints and make recommendations there. But then there was a second important component called the auditor monitor. And this is completely separate from the current auditor's office that we have. But the auditor monitor would be a more of a hired position that would be the kind of go-between the police department and this civilian group. Being able to compile data and testimonies and information and be able to present this to the citizen group. And so right now, what the ordinance that we're working on right now is really focusing on just first and foremost getting that civilian part created, the part of the group of residents who are going to be doing the main decision making and the recommendations, and getting them established. And that's what this ordinance does right now. But one of the things that we know it needs to do is it needs to at least mention and how it's going to interact with that auditor monitor position that is going to be created after we get the civilian oversight group put in place. And so that's one of the things that we're still trying to hinge on getting in place. But the draft ordinance that we're working on right now establishes that group. Right now, what we're recommending is 9 individuals from the community, along with some non-voting ex officio members that would be from some of the the police department and the jail and the sheriff's department, and how that will be structured. But we're still having to figure out those details of how the auditor monitor and the civilian group are going to interact. And that's kind of where we're at right now.
Tell us a little bit more about the importance behind this position.
Yeah, the auditor monitor is integral for this to be successful. And the task force, the citizen task force that kind of made this recommendation, they realized that because they studied a lot of civilian police oversight groups across the country, ones that succeeded and ones that failed. And a common thread between the ones that succeeded were that they had the necessary and adequate staff support to make this successful. You know, we're pulling a lot of our recommendations right now from Atlanta, and Atlanta first created theirs back in 2007, and it didn't really go anywhere. It wasn't able to do the work it was intended to do because within that ordinance that created it, they hadn't really established the staff support that's going to be there to make sure it could work. And so they kind of reworked that group, rewrote the ordinance, and supplied staffing and an executive director to make sure it could be successful. And since then, it's been a really, really successful group that's done its charge well, and also started earning trust a lot in the community. And being somewhere that you know, people in the Atlanta community who are having issues with the police can go to. And so we're able to look at that and say, okay, we have to have this staff support from the get-go, or else we might be setting up this group to fail. And that's exactly what we don't want to do.
Well, and again, the auditor monitor being sort of a go-between between the public group and the police force, if I understand you correctly.
And just to clarify, yeah, the idea behind what they're doing and responsibilities will be is that they will be that go-between. And a lot of that's because when working with complaints and, you know, possible violations by police officers, all those things are under investigation. And of course, there's privacy matters that get tied into that. And we can't open up those investigations to an entire group of just civilians. But we can have a specified individual, which would be this auditor monitor, can sit in on those interviews, hear the testimony, be able to look at data, be able to look at video and audio before it's released to the public, and be able to bring those observations back to that civilian board for them to be able to consider and get a clearer idea of what's going on. So, I mean, that shows you another integral reason why we have to have that auditor monitor there for this work.
Well, when do you think we can expect the ordinance to go before the full mayor and commission? And do you have a sense at this point how the commission feels about the ordinance?
So that we're having our last meeting, hopefully, of GOC before we send this off on September 23rd. And the goal is for us to go ahead and vote on Tuesday, October 5th for the full mayor commission on the recommendations. And at that point, of course, there's a lot that could happen. It could be tabled, be delayed, or it could be voted up, yes or no. You know, I know that a lot of the commissioners who don't sit on GOC are following these discussions very closely, and I've talked with other commissioners about it. And I know that a lot of the commissioner wants to see us follow the task force recommendations since they did so much work on this, and I agree with them. So I'm hopeful that these recommendations will be embraced and passed so that we can get the civilian board component in place, start getting people appointed to that and get it established. And then and in the months to come, have the auditor monitor position also create and establish and fill it too. So, you know, within, 6 months or so, I'm hoping that we have this full operation running and going so that we can be establishing more and more trust between the community and the police department.
Tim Denson is the ACC District 5 Commissioner. Thanks so much for taking some time with Athens News Matters today.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
I'm Tim Franks. From the biggest breaking stories of the day to the important issues and trends, We're there.
This is an historic victory and what is a very important day.
This could change world history.
Everybody's going to pay a price. He will, everybody will.
And I am just so happy to be home and to put my feet on this land again.
Another huge development.
Join me and my colleagues for NewsHour from the BBC.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley. Seven people were injured in a shooting just before 2 o'clock Sunday morning as a brawl escalated and a man began firing a gun into the crowd, according to Athens-Clarke County Police. Five victims were transported to a hospital with non-life-threatening injuries, and later, two more arrived at the hospital on their own accord. The suspect, 21-year-old Pharaoh Williams of Washington, Georgia, is charged with possession of a firearm during the commission of a felony and seven counts of aggravated assault. The ACCPD is still searching for motive for the shooting and for the fight, as well as any photos or videos taken near the crime. Here to talk about that, plus the rest of the weekend news, are Gwen O'Looney with WXAG, Chris Dowd with Athens Politics Nerd, and Caitlin Stroh Page with the Athens Banner Herald. So thanks for being here today, everyone. So this might be the largest shooting spree we've had in Athens, at least in years. It's been almost a full work week, and we still don't know very much about the shooting. Do you guys have any other details that I just didn't hear about?
The guy turned himself in Wilkes County, his home county. And we were very lucky that either he was, you know, so drunk he couldn't aim well or didn't mean to kill people. But, you know, this is that time at when bars are emptying people who have been drinking a lot, and now we mix in people carrying guns. These kind of events are frightening. But our police were great. They were right on the scene very quickly. And they want help. They want people to turn in anything they've seen to help them in completing this case, resolving the case.
Yeah, and I will add that we technically don't know that he was drunk, at least not that I've read. Like, well, that's sort of a dot to connect, especially where he was. We don't know that. And so who knows what this could have been related to him. But the person who was charged, not physically in the fight himself, police don't believe. They believe he was kind of a bystander. And so there's a lot of sort of missing puzzle pieces as far as motive. I mean, it's late at night, and you know, what's the old saying, like nothing good happens after midnight, you know, it's sort of that kind of thought process, but we don't know if he was drunk, how he knew these people, what they were fighting over. And so there's a lot of questions to be answered about that. We don't know if, I mean, from everything I've read, we don't know if, you know, if it was that he was aiming for one person and sprayed and got other people. We don't really know any of that yet. And so agreed. It's really fortunate that no one died in this, and we're really fortunate that they were all non-life-threatening injuries, but it's hard to know just how, I mean, I hate to use the word fortunate, but it's hard to know how fortunate or how worried we should be when we don't really know much past that.
Caitlin, you're absolutely right. We don't know. People were celebrating. People were, I'm sure, drinking, but we don't know what state he was in when he fired into the crowd. But that's something that hopefully we'll know more about in the coming days and weeks. Let's move on to the commission. And commissioners met earlier this week where they voted to require county employees to get vaccinated. Chris, I want to talk to you about this. I understand there was a last-minute move to change the word mandate to directive.
Right. I think that made sense. That was Commissioner Myers, who brought that up, she was saying that, you know, the policy really isn't a mandate. So it's kind of puzzling why it's listed like that. And I think it's just because, you know, the commissioners wanted to be, you know, tough on this issue. So they called it a mandate. But, you know, it's really an incentive-based program where you'll get, you know, a day off of paid leave. You'll get $200 if you're vaccinated by November 10th. And beyond that, there really isn't any progressive discipline associated with it, like they do have with their mask ordinance. That is absolutely required. And employees could even be terminated if they keep violating that. But for the vaccines, there isn't anything like that. And so so Myers wanted to change it to, I think, directive is what she said.
It's kind of like the Athens mask mandate, right? In that it's not really a mandate. It's this sort of like incentive / ordinance / policy. There is no mandate. If you aren't vaccinated by the November, 10th, 12th deadline, nothing really happens to you. I thought that Melissa Link was spot on when she was like, this is just an incentive program. We can call it what it is, but it's nothing more than an incentive program. And so that was, I don't like that they're calling it a mandate because it's not. I think it's a little bit disingenuous, but I can also see that I think that commissioners, you know, they kind of maybe wink, wink, want it to be perceived as a mandate. I thought that was a little chaotic and a little strange in how it was executed, but it is what it is now.
I think across the nation, people are trying to figure out what are the, you know, when you get into people's health and vaccinations and that sort of thing, they're trying to make sure that they're walking a fine line. And I think that it's new territory and they're right to be careful. Mandate is a very strong word, whereas directive and other things are probably more appropriate at this time.
Of course, they can always change their mind. If people don't get vaccinated and things keep getting worse, then they might change their mind and have an actual mandate. So we'll see.
Right. Commissioners also approved a set of T-SPLOST projects for the Atlanta Highway and Lexington Road corridors. Can you tell us what those look like?
Well, you know, it's a more pedestrian look is what they're looking for. They're sticking with the parking in the back, and that gives that Lowe's whole stretch there an opportunity to put stores in on the front and create a more... they're looking at making that, that's our entrance way. That's one of our entrance ways. And I think that they're doing a good job of looking at the ways in which that can be done effectively.
Yeah, on the Lexington Road corridor, yeah, there's $4 million. And there was a user group that had to choose how to spend that money. And they got to choose between sidewalks, multi-use trails, improving intersection safety, and then some projects at the airport and or bus stops. And they ended up recommending sidewalks, yeah, especially along Lexington Road itself, and then also some bus stops and intersection safety improvements. Now over in Atlanta Highway, it's a little bit of a different situation. So it was the same question put to a user group, and they also had $4 million. But the user group there focused on two multi-use trails, one along Timothy Road and one along Mitchell Ridge Road. But neither of those is actually on Atlanta Highway. And so the T-SPLOST Oversight Committee actually voted unanimously to reject these recommendations. And they were kind of thinking that this isn't what voters had in mind for how to spend that money. And so we have like these two different user groups saying two different things. And so they had to kind of work out a compromise proposal that is only going to spend some of that money and it's going to spend the rest of it on just making conceptual designs. And they're kind of punting to T-SPLOST 2023 is basically a way to look at it. They're not really going to spend, they're going to spend less from 2018 and they're just doing a bunch of designs is what the compromise proposal was. And they also want the user group to come back with $1.5 million that could be spent on projects that are actually along Atlanta Highway.
Let's move to the state now, where a federal judge ruled to make it significantly easier for third-party candidates to appear on the ballot for the U.S. House and other elections in Georgia. Before, 1943 state law required a petition to be signed by at least 5% of registered voters for a third-party candidate to appear on the ballot. But now that hurdle has been reduced to 1%, and candidates nominated by Republican and Democratic parties automatically appear on the ballot. So this makes it easier, obviously, for a third party to get on. What are your thoughts about that? And how do you think that could change the landscape for future elections?
Very few candidates think Georgia is fertile ground for a third party. one. So we haven't had that much activity related to third party, but Green has succeeded in the past. And I'm glad to see that this barrier has been lowered to a greater representation of different ideas. I think that's always good for democracy, is to have different ideas being shared with the voters.
Yeah, I think it's great too. And in an AJC article about this, they mentioned that, which I didn't know, that no third party US House candidate had ever qualified under these rules. And so that's why they were changing it. And now that I think about it, yeah, they're like libertarian, Senate candidates, but there are no libertarian House candidates. And I never connected those dots, but it's because the signature requirement is so much greater. And they're kind of evening that out with this decision. So let's take District 10. So you would need like 25,000 signatures to qualify as a third party candidate. And now you only need like 5,000, which is much more doable. But I don't think this is going to have any effect, really. I think, it's still going to be Republicans against Democrats. I don't think the third parties are all that relevant, to be honest. But this is at least, it'll give them a small boost. Maybe there'll be an extra name on the ballot, perhaps.
Maybe it matters in a runoff.
Yeah, maybe. Or a really close race, maybe.
Maybe. But right, it's still pretty much two parties. Do you think there's any way to see this as a voting rights issue?
Well, if it is, it just shows that the courts care more about voters than our legislature.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah, I think it is a voting rights issue. Sure. Yeah, people should be allowed to vote for whatever candidate they want. There shouldn't be these artificial barriers in place for stopping them from doing that. Because if you could get 5% of the people in that district to vote for you as a third party, like, you're not a third party. Like, you're right up there with the main two. So, it was basically impossible.
I think that's maybe the only reason that you would oppose this, is if you, in theory, think that 15, 20 people are going to enter a race and be able to qualify under this. But even that feels really extreme. Like, I just don't, I mean, you might get one or two more people. And even then, I just don't see a third party candidate taking away enough of the vote from either of the party selected candidates. I just don't, I mean, maybe it'll be a little bit of an increase, but I don't know. Like you said, we're so polarized right now. Maybe if there were some third party candidate that emerged that kind of chipped away at the left of center and right of center people. But I also think that so many people right now understand that there's solidarity is how you win elections, and you might not love your candidate, but you're going to win if you're going to get something you don't want if you don't vote for the candidate you'd rather have. And so I don't know. I mean, I heard a lot of people talk about like write-ins during the runoff, which I don't know. I just don't see it making a big enough of an issue right now.
Yeah, I agree. Like in 2000, when Ralph Nader ran, I think, he made a decent argument that the two parties were sort of similar and he could appeal to some other people. But today, like, the parties are very, very different. I think anyone can see that. And so I just don't see third parties making any headway in this kind of environment when we're so polarized. It's just Republican or Democrat right now.
That is it for the panel this week. I want to thank the panelists, Caitlin Stroh Page with the Athens Banner Herald, Chris Dowd with Athens Politics Nerd, and Gwen O'Looney with WXAG.
Morning Edition goes to the source, to the people affected by the news.
This plant could shut down, and a lot of very good people could lose their jobs.
Like this, it's completely ridiculous that we should feel unsafe to go to school.
I'm Noelle King. For stories that matter to you, listen every weekday to Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. On the morning of September 11, 2001, Greg Trevor was in his office on the 68th floor of One World Trade Center. 20 years later, Trevor, Associate Vice President for Marketing and Communications at the University of Georgia, remembers that day and its aftermath.
I'd trade all my tomorrows for one single yesterday. this haunting lyric written by Kris Kristofferson and Fred Foster and made famous by the legendary Janis Joplin, has been stuck in my brain as the 20th anniversary of 9/11 approaches. As a survivor of the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center, I often wonder how it would feel to experience a single day without the trauma and the guilt of living through September 11. I know that's not possible. I expect to suffer from the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder and survivor guilt for the rest of my life. I also know that, no matter how painful, I have an obligation to serve as a living witness to the horror and heroism of 9/11. Here in Athens, Georgia, where our family has lived for nearly 5 years, most of our friends and colleagues have never met another World Trade Center survivor. This includes a whole generation of young men and women who were not even born 20 years ago. They have never been taught that the heroes of September 11, both uniformed personnel and civilians, enabled an estimated 25,000 people to escape the World Trade Center complex that day, one of the most successful evacuations in human history. That's why I try to make time every semester to meet with University of Georgia professor Yan Jin's crisis communication class. Her students always appreciate learning about these heroic men and women. Heroes like David Lim, a police officer with the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, who rescued countless people, including me, from a blocked stairwell in Tower 1 minutes before the building collapsed. David, a canine officer whose partner, Sirius, was killed in the attacks, was later trapped in the rubble for nearly 5 hours. He retired as a Port Authority police lieutenant in 2014. We remain friends to this day. And heroes like Port Authority Police Captain Kathy Mazza, the first woman commandant of the department's police academy. Kathy led a group of academy instructors into the Trade Center a few minutes after the first attack. Most of them didn't make it out. Kathy was the first female Port Authority police officer killed in the line of duty. I keep her photo on the bulletin board in my office. I think about Kathy and the others who made the ultimate sacrifice on 9/11 every time I walk into the gym at Oconee Veterans Park a few miles from our home, and I see the flag of honor that displays their names. When our family is in church, I say a special prayer for them. May their bodies find eternal rest, their souls find eternal joy and salvation, and their families find eternal comfort. I am grateful for their heroism and for everything that I have been fortunate to experience, both good and bad, over the past 2 decades. Celebrating 28 years of marriage with my wife, best friend, and love of my life, Allison Salerno. Watching our 2 sons, Gabe and Lucas, grow up to be happy, healthy, hardworking, and caring young men. Support from family and friends across the country for our idea to make September 11 a national day of discussion, where we honor the sacrifices of the heroes of 9/11 by finding common ground across political, religious, and cultural divides. Coaching hundreds of boys and girls on baseball and basketball teams in New Jersey and Georgia, then staying in touch with them as they become successful adults. My fellow staff at the Port Authority, we share a bond that can never be broken. The past 17 years working with outstanding colleagues at Rutgers University and the University of Georgia, promoting the value of public higher education as a powerful engine of economic opportunity and social mobility. Above all, I am grateful to be alive. On difficult days, the painful memories of September 11 can still be overwhelming. When that happens, I take a deep breath and remember these 2 truths. Every day is a gift. Every breath is a blessing.
Greg Trevor, Associate Vice President for Marketing and Communications at the University of Georgia, worked for the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey from 1998 to 2004. He was in his office on the 68th floor of One World Trade Center on the morning of September 11, 2001. This essay first appeared in James Magazine, Insider Advantage, Georgia.
All Things Considered has been there through controversial wars.
Thousands of young people came to Washington.
National disasters.
Challenger, go with throttle up.
The explosion in the clear blue Florida
and breakthrough
sky.
Moments.
Just let it sink in. An African American president of the United States of America.
4 decades of bringing you the news on All Things Considered every afternoon.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup. For years, the West Broad School site has been the subject of intense controversy for the Clark County School District. The site, which is a historic reminder of the separate but equal era in public education, has been the focal point of debate and disagreement between historic preservation advocates and the school district. Last week, the Board of Education saw two possible plans for the site. Both would preserve the 1939 Minor Street building, but one plan calls for the complete demolition of a 1950s building on Campbell Lane. Earlier this week, WUGA's Alexia Ridley spoke to Tommy Valentine of Historic Athens about his concerns about the plans. Here's their conversation.
Can you tell us about the Clark County School District's possible plans for the West Broad School campus?
At the school board meeting, after 3 years of spirited dialogue that's included letters to the editor, rallies, protests, celebration of the history of the West Broad School, and just a general growing consensus on the need to preserve the site, we are concerned to see that the school board is prepared to vote between two options, neither of which is the full preservation of the site. Instead, the school board will be choosing between option A, the originally proposed hatchet job of the site, which was to leave only the Minor Street building and demolish three quarters of the historic campus, erasing the entire separate but equal history of the site, or option B, an improved but still not complete rehabilitation of the site, in which the Jim Crow era Minor Street building would be saved, the equalization era, separate but equal era, Campbell Lane building would be saved, and then a new building would be constructed that would allow additional classrooms and utilization of the space.
Can you take us through Historic Athens' involvement in trying to preserve the building?
A little over 3 years ago, we received a call from individuals involved with preserving African-American cultural spaces around the state of Georgia. And they were concerned that Athens was taking the West Broad School for granted. At the time, the school district was still referring to all but the Minor Street building as non-historic buildings, despite their architectural value, despite their age, despite their excellent condition, and despite the fact that they were telling a completely different story. I mean, for those of us that took Georgia history or history classes, you may remember Jim Crow era history is different than the separate but equal era of the 50s. And so these were two entirely different stories, and Athens was on a collision course to erase the separate but equal history on the site. And in doing so, by the way, not only erased the history, but some really excellent buildings that had unique architectural value in what's called the international style. So we were called in. We coordinated with the school district in 2019 to put out a joint statement that we would work together as partners for the preservation of the campus. And for the last 3 years, we have been working both behind the scenes and out on the front lines to try to advocate for the preservation of this 150-year-old important space. And it is important not only for African-American history, it's important when you're trying to understand the general educational history of Athens, Georgia, and how it worked. So we at times have felt like we've been successful, most notably in June when the state of Georgia formally recognized the entire campus as eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. Unfortunately, at least one staff member at the school district has felt that they could not afford to feel wrong, that their first attempt at this, well before this community effort started, doing a crude preservation job on one building and destroying the rest, they felt the need that attempt must have been right from the beginning. And so for 3 years, it's been two steps forward, one step back, where we'll make progress with the superintendent and school board and with the community, only to find that staff member is doggedly sticking to their original vision. And ultimately, that's what tonight's school board meeting is going to be about. It's going to be about whether or not that individual effectively gets his way.
Can you tell us about the history of the Campbell Lane building?
So the entire campus was founded 150 years ago. In the late 1800s, there was an initial building that no longer stands. Then in the 1930s, the Minor Street building was built during what is commonly referred to as the Jim Crow era. In the 1950s, interestingly, after Separate But Equal had already been overruled by the Supreme Court, Athens brought to town an architect to build Alps Elementary. And while the architect was here, they asked that same architect, an award-winning architect, Richard Eck, to do a two-for-one. And this is typically how Separate But Equal would work. You'd bring an architect out, they would do a school for whites and a school for African-American students. While they were preparing Alps, they prepared to augment the West Broad campus, which demonstrated a continued commitment in Athens towards segregated education, even after that Supreme Court ruling. So what was constructed was a brick courtyard, a lovely international style two-story building. That's the building we call the Campbell Lane building. And then also an additional structure that has come to be known as the cafetorium, half cafeteria, half auditorium off that courtyard. When you visit the campus today, it still gives you a tremendous sense of place. You're walking on the courtyard where 70 years ago, children and teachers walk. And it's an incredibly important historic space. The Campbell Lane building, which I've been inside and have gotten to inspect the condition of, is absolutely a restorable building. It is in remarkable shape. It was clearly well-designed and well-built. And so it represents a real opportunity to preserve forever here in Athens, Clark County, the history of the Separate But Equal era in Athens. Is that a painful history for some, for many? Yes. But it's also important to note that it's a critical history for everyone to understand. And it is a school that there are living teachers and living students still today that look back fondly on their times at that school. And so it would be a real loss for the community for that building to come down.
Tommy Valentine, thank you for spending some time with us on the show today.
Alexia, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Tommy Valentine is the Executive Director of Historic Athens. He spoke last week to my colleague, Alexia Ridley. And on Thursday night, the Clark County Board of Education voted to accept neither of the proposed plans and instead sent the project back to the drawing board in a narrow 5-4 vote.
For a century, the tobacco industry has aggressively and deliberately marketed products to women and girls with, among others, ads like this.
New Virginia Slims in the Slim Purse Pack.
You've got your own cigarette now, baby. You've come a long way.
A new report from the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids details how the industry has marketed to women and girls and the resulting consequences to women's health. Recently, I spoke with Lori Rubiner, Executive Vice President of Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, and Tammy Boyd, Chief Policy Officer and Senior Counsel for Black Women's Health Imperative, about the report. Here's our conversation. And let's start with the findings of this report. What ways did the report show that the tobacco industry is actually using predatory marketing practices on women and girls?
So this is Lori, and I can start. The report details the tobacco industry's long history of targeting women and girls. They use slick marketing campaigns. I think most of us who are a little bit older remember in the 60s, the Virginia Slims, the kind of iconic You've Come a Long Way, Baby ad campaign. They have these way of using themes that touch on beauty, fashion, and sophistication. Most of them now have migrated over to social media marketing e-cigarettes and cigarettes to young girls using social media influencers, paid influencers, promoting it through parties and that kind of thing.
Would you say it's similar to how tobacco companies sort of targeted Black Americans with menthol cigarettes and that sort of thing?
It's very much the same tactics. 85% of African Americans smoke menthol cigarettes, much to their detriment. You know, menthol masks the harsher effects of cigarette smoking and makes it easier to get addicted to cigarettes. And then the consequences of long-term addiction, it's very similar with their marketing to women. They've segmented out women and identified the kinds of things that might appeal to women in the same ways that they've identified the kind of marketing tactics that would appeal to African Americans. And they've been very successful in both instances.
And Tammy, let me ask you, what are some of the negative health consequences that women and girls face who use tobacco products?
So, for example, tobacco use impacts young women's her ability to become pregnant and often serious pregnancy complications as well. Smoking and exposure to secondhand smoke are also harmful to a baby's health before and afterwards. And then it also can last throughout their childhood and teenage years. And again, it really spans throughout a woman's entire life. We fast forward as a woman ages, smoking is a major risk factor for Alzheimer's disease, osteoporosis, also macular degeneration that can lead to blindness. Also, it puts women at an increased risk for deadly diseases during adulthood, such as heart disease, lung cancer. And for example, disproportionate impacts Black women because lung cancer is a leading cause of cancer death among Black women, causing 20% of all cancer deaths.
And can you tell me what you would like to see regards to possibly policy solutions?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two main things that we'd really like to see. The first is see a ban on menthol cigarettes. The second is ban flavored e-cigarettes, which really just appeal to young people. You know, there are 15,000 different flavored e-cigarettes like mango, Captain Crunch. There are 3.6 million kids in the United States who right now use e-cigarettes, and they're really designed to addict kids to nicotine.
And Tammy, can I ask you to tell people where they can go to get help if they want to break away from their tobacco addiction or just get off tobacco products?
Yes. So smokers who would like to get help in quitting, they can call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. That's QUITNOW. And they can visit smokefree.gov. And then also for more resources and copy of the report, they can go to campaignfortobaccofreekid.org.
We know that it's really hard to quit, but that it can be done. No matter what age you quit, it will have benefits for your health in the long term.
Lori Rubiner is the Executive Vice President of Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. And Tammy Boyd is the Chief Policy Officer and Senior Counsel for Black Women's Health Imperative. According to the CDC, about 38% of American adults have high cholesterol. But researchers in the University of Georgia's College of Family and Consumer Sciences say that one key to reducing cholesterol could be growing in your backyard. A new study shows that consuming a healthy amount of pecans can reduce cholesterol levels. Liana Guarneri is a doctoral student in the College of Family and Consumer Sciences and one of the study's authors. Welcome to Athens News Matters.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
For starters, who participated in the study and what was their process for carrying out the procedures?
Right. So we had 58 adults, and they either were overweight or obese or had high cholesterol. So they came in for a screening visit first where we would check to make sure that they qualified for their study. They couldn't have any other chronic diseases, no diabetes. They couldn't be on medication. So we had a lot of exclusion factors. Once we confirmed that they qualified for this study, they came in for a visit at baseline 4 weeks and 8 weeks. And at those visits, we drew blood and measured metric measurements. And throughout the study, they completed food diaries so we could make sure that their diet was consistent throughout the study. And they completed physical activity questionnaires and kept compliance logs of their consumption of the pecans.
Can you tell us more about the pecan-enriched diet that the candidates consumed?
Right. So this was a free-living diet, meaning the participants either added pecans to their diet with no diet instructions, or they received instructions on, we told them to substitute the calories that are in pecans for foods that they normally would eat. And so we didn't provide any other foods. The diet instructions weren't complicated. So this makes the findings of the study very generalizable to the public because the message is that if you add pecans to your diet, you too can see beneficial effects.
And what were the results after the 8-week intervention?
Right. So we saw in both pecan groups, so we had two of them, the one with instructions and without instructions. We saw decreases in total cholesterol, LDL, decreases in some of the ratios, total cholesterol to HDL ratio, decreases in triglycerides, and decreases in apolipoprotein B, which is another protein that's associated with cardiovascular disease.
Well, that's really great. So what did the instruction group have to do differently from the other group?
So they completed a food diary before they ever came in for a visit. I would counsel them when they came in. So we'd look at their food diary and I would tell them how many calories are in the pecans that I'm providing. And we would look at foods that they would consume. Typically it would be snack foods, or sometimes people would replace their breakfast with the pecans. But it was very individualized counseling that we did to make sure that they could adequately find ways to substitute the pecans for foods that they would habitually eat in their diet.
Like chips.
Exactly.
How many pecans should you eat during the day to reduce cholesterol levels?
So the dose that we used in the study was 68 grams. And so this is over two servings. It's about like 3/4 of a cup.
And did you discover any other health benefits for maintaining a pecan-enriched diet?
Yes, but the data is still being analyzed and papers will be out soon. So we are looking at a lot of other outcomes like antioxidant status, appetite, but those results aren't out yet.
So that's great. There's going to be follow-up information to this study that already discovered this great benefit of lowering cholesterol.
Absolutely. And it's really exciting because there was a lot of research on other tree nuts prior to this, and pecans seemed to get a bad rap because they're associated with Thanksgiving. And so people thought that they were less healthy. So it's exciting to see that they have similar beneficial effects.
Before we go, I have to ask you one of the most contentious questions. Is it pecan or pecan?
Well, apparently in Georgia, it's pecan, but I grew up saying pecan. So it's a big controversy in my research.
Thank you again. I really do appreciate it. And I think it is some interesting information.
Yeah, thank you. It feels good when people are interested in what I've been working on for so many years.
Liana Guarneri is a doctoral student in the College of Family and Consumer Sciences, Department of Nutritional Sciences.
You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. Our producers are Martin Matheny, Gene Davis, Lucas Trevor, Devin Zwald, Kara Nelson, and Abby Buston. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia.
If you've enjoyed one of the stories on this week's broadcast or want to listen again to some of our previous reporting and interviews, you can find all of our work online at WUGA.org. For Chris Shoup, I'm Alexia Ridley. As always, thanks for listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News.